represent the Fish Lake and Dixie National Forest. Want to recognize Jake Albright from Wildlife Board in the audience. And let's introduce the RAC, starting on my right tonight. Max?
Mac Morrell, Bicknell, representing agriculture.
Cordell Pearson, Circleville, representing at large.
Mike Staley, Delta, at large.
Dave Black, St. George, representing at large.
Dale Bagley from Marysville, representing an elected official.
Bruce Bonebreak, Regional Supervisor, Division of Wildlife.
Lane Torgerson, Sportsman's Representative from Richville.
Sam Carpenter, Sportsman Representative, Kanab.
I'm Claire Woodbury from Hurricane. I represent the public at large.
Mike Worthen from Cedar City, public at large.
Harry Barber, I represent the BLM. I work out of the Kanab field office where I'm the manager there.
Thank you. As far as order of the meeting tonight, we'll first have presentations by the Division of Wildlife. Ask that you be patient and respectful and let them get through the presentation. We'll then proceed on to questions from the RAC and then questions from the public and then comments from the public. Fill out a comment card if there's an agenda item that you'd like to speak to. We'd love to hear from you. That's what we're all here for. Then we'll proceed to comments from the RAC and motions and voting. With that, I have one switching of the order on the agenda, if everybody's got one in front of them. Because of audiovisual needs down here and what information's on which machines, we'd like to switch waterfowl with predator control. So we'll go bobcat harvest, then predator control, then waterfowl. So 5-7-6. If no one objects, need a motion and we'll approve this agenda. I might also so moved by Mike, second by Mac. Those in favor? Unanimous. I've got a comment card here about the Cougar Guidebook and Rule, which is often on this meeting. We don't have it on the agenda tonight. But we're here to take public comment, and so I think what I'd like to do is, sir, if you want to stick around, we'll do this under other business, and we'll get it into the minutes, and then we'll make sure the Wildlife Board hears about it. Yeah, I think it's one of the multi-year proclamations, and, you know, maybe it shouldn't be multiple year proclamation. Maybe it should be something addressed every year. We'll let the powers be decide. Appreciate you being here. With that, let me talk to Wildlife, about the Wildlife Board meeting. It seemed like it was a long time ago, back in that hot, dry month we had of June. One thing I wanted to let the RAC and folks know about that board meeting, there's an action log item. Sometimes we ask for items to be added to the action log. This one may be of interest. A motion that they asked the division to give a presentation on the preference point system relative to the new 30-year deer unit plan. So how would this preference point system look like across the 30 deer units? You know, usually there's a discussion about how many people have points and how they're scattered, whether that needs to be readdressed. Moving on to the substantive stuff that we discussed here and was contentious. The deer management plan was passed as presented after a fair amount of discussion. After lots of discussion, and I want to recognize Mac Morrell for traveling to the meeting as well as several other folks from the southern region. We spent a lot of time talking about the Wildlife Board debated the elk management plans, and it was a vote in the end of 4-2 that passed as was presented by the division. There were other motions that didn't carry, but that's what passed 4-2. So it was controversial, not necessarily contentious, but thorough discussion. I think that's all. And we have any questions about the Wildlife Board meeting? Mac, again, thanks for being there and supporting the RAC and the Fish Lake Management Plan process. I don't know how you felt about the meeting up there. They were wringing their hands. Yeah. Turn it over to Bruce. Regional update.
Okay, I don't have too much to report. We have had a one personnel change. We now have a new regional fisheries manager. Richard Hepworth has accepted that position, and he's in place and up and going. We would like to welcome you to the region. I don't know how many of you here remember his dad, Dale Hepworth, but I worked with him for many years, so it's kind of a continuation. What's that? Oh, okay, yeah. And we have a new biologist out of Fillmore in the Beaver area, Riley Peck. Riley, could you stand up and just so everybody can see who you are? Riley's a new employee down here. He's worked for the division for how many years, Riley? 4 or 5, okay. And so we're happy to have him down here. I'm sure he's going to do us a good job. Other things in the region, we will be conducting interviews in 2 weeks for the regional habitat manager position. We've got some really strong candidates for that, so I feel like we'll end up with somebody very good in that position, and we'll be conducting those on the 15th. Lastly, I'd like to report, I found out just today, and I talked about this, I think, last time, about US 89, the highway project down there. A federal grant's come in for $1.5 million to add on to that project. So I think I reported last time that we would probably be doing that more piecemeal. It'll still be somewhat that way, but we've probably got about 3/4 of the money needed for that. So that project, hopefully, they'll be starting to let the contract sometime this winter, and they should be able to make a big push and get the majority of that done pretty quickly. So pretty happy about that. The Grand Staircase Escalante is the one that put in for the grant and got the money. So, wow. So and that's about it.
Thanks, Bruce. Any questions? Seeing none, let's move on.
I have a couple of questions.
Come to the mic.
Lee Tracy, United Wildlife Cooperative. Can you give us an update on the Navajo Lake dike project? And also, what's happening with that proposed transplant of the deer on the Panguitch Lake front, or the, Parowan front unit?
Okay, since there's nobody from fisheries here, I'll answer the one on Navajo Lake, and then I'll defer the other one to our wildlife manager, Teresa Griffin. Sorry, Teresa, almost said Bonzo. As far as Navajo Lake, that's moving along about as fast as you could expect. They're waiting for it to dry up as much as they need to do the core samples to find out how sturdy the dike is and what exactly we need to do. I think we're all kind of suspecting that we're going to need to replace that dike eventually, but the procedure right now is to try to repair the hole that's in the dike. We have enough money, I think, with what we've collected so far to probably do that repair. We don't have enough to replace the dike, but we're working on that on several fronts. Hopefully, I mean, the goal there is to completely replace that dike. The problem is that dike gets inundated with water from time to time, and anybody that knows anything about dams and dam repair, that's not a good thing for a dike. You get all kinds of piping, That dike's actually, I mean, it was put in shortly after the turn of the century. It's been there a long time. It's held up pretty well. We have repaired it, though I can't remember exactly. It's like 4 or 6 times, something like that. Yeah, so. What's that?
Which century?
Turn of the century.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The previous one.
So anyway, I'm pretty happy with the way I'm seeing that go. We've got a lot of partners on that. Both counties, Kane County and Iron County, have come in as partners. Kane County actually come up with $50,000 put towards the repair. So I feel pretty confident we'll probably get that repaired about as quickly as possible, which probably means about a year and a half, something like that. And the complete replacement of that dike would take several years, but we're trying to move in that direction. So does that answer your question on Navajo?
What about the deer transplant?
Okay, Teresa, would you address where we're at with that?
Yeah, we just got a proposal from BYU kind of outlining what we're going to do. They're overseeing the study. Each deer will be collared. I think we will probably break it into two groups, maybe 50 in the winter and 50 in the spring. Each one does have to have a live CWD test conducted, but it won't be too complicated. So it'll probably happen about mid-December, the first 50. Taken off the Parowan Front where you've toured before, the north end of the Parowan Front. And our new biologist, Riley, is looking at areas to put them on probably the north end of the Pavant up near Holden. So we'll keep you informed, I'm sure, that volunteer help. It will be net gun capture. Absolutely. We will need people to help us. We'll be hauling a lot of horse trailers up there and a lot of animal handling, so we'll keep in touch.
Thanks, Trace. Let's get into this agenda then. Agenda item number 5, Bobcat Harvest Recommendations. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Okay, this one should be fairly straightforward and simple relative to some of the other plans. This Bobcat plan is very straightforward. This one at this point is still every year we do our Bobcats versus some of the other ones, our bears, our cougars, that we've gone on to 3-year recommendations. So you'll see me back here every time, every year at this time. But we'll get through it pretty quick. Okay. The way the Bobcat plan works, again, it's like the other ones where there are certain performance targets. What we're able to do is we measure different variables in the population through both surveys and what the take is when we do our check-ins. We're looking for specific target ranges. These target ranges were based on historical highs and lows, and that's sort of a historical range that we've seen over the years. A certain proportion of kittens and yearlings taken, adults, survival is something we calculate based on those numbers, percent females intake, and then we'll survey folks for the set days per bobcat. So we use these target ranges to put together what we want to get to. Relative to 2012 data, so what we had last year, our kittens and yearlings 0.35, adult survival 0.7, percent females 0.45, set days per bobcat at 400. So what this means relative to the plan and targets, most of our variables are right here within range. However, two of them are still out. So the proportion of kittens and yearlings is down a little low, and our set days per bobcat is a little high. So the way the plan was written last year, we'd have to keep on knocking back tags. But there was an adjustment made last year that added. So we should back up a little bit. According to the plan, if two performance targets are outside of range, you adjust the number of tags per individual 1 to 2. However, you can keep the number of tags consistent with the previous year if variables are moving towards target ranges. So we go back and look at those variables again and look at what we have now. Our kittens and yearlings, again, we're in 2011, we're at 0.31. Now we're at 0.35. We're going in the right direction. The other two are in. And then set days per popcat is going down, moving towards the right direction as well. So makes it a simple decision for us. According to the plan, 2 out of the 4 moving in the right direction. So we're going to recommend consistency with what the previous year was. And that is, if you read our guidebook, what we're recommending for this year, it's going to look exactly like last year's, except for some change, altering the dates to fit so we don't hit Sundays or whatever. Specifically, maximum number of permits, 4,600, limit of 3 permits for individual, and an equivalent season from November 28th until February 3rd, 2013. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the RAC? Sam.
I probably should know this, but when you put this, the 0.42, 0.65, and these different numbers, how do you correlate that to numbers? Is that with something to do with the population or age? What do those numbers mean?
Okay, let me see if I can find. Is that right? So we're looking at, so just these target ranges, or so for the proportion of kittens and yearlings, that's out of the harvest take.
That's a percentage,
that's
essentially.
That's a percentage, sorry, proportion, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I should say proportion females. Okay, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, there's a big lengthy management plan behind that that describes all that. Any other questions? Good question, Sam. Questions from the public? I don't have any comment cards for Fur Bear. So it's ours to deal with. No changes, essentially. Lane.
I make a motion that we accept the Bobcat recommendation as presented by the division.
Motion by Lane, seconded by Sam. Any discussion? Let's vote. Those in favor? Any against? Unanimous. So let's move on into agenda item 7, the predator control program. This is informational, so we won't be looking for a motion voting, but you're welcome to ask questions. Go ahead, John.
Thank you. So I put this together fairly quickly today. We realized this program has been a real whirlwind tour of trying to get something pretty big up and running. So I wanted to put together kind of basics of what we've got going and what we've got started up, so at least you guys and anybody interested in the public can see where we're going with this. So it's a not too complicated, but there's some different aspects of it that are kind of interesting. Predator Control Incentive Program, just to give a little background and history in terms of what we're doing with predators and have been in this state. This graph shows, you know, last year's numbers in terms of what we spend for predator control in Utah relative to some of the other neighboring states. As you can see, historically, we've already been more than all the 4 neighboring states combined. What's going to happen this year is that's going to go off the graph, so we're going to go up to 1.1 million relative to what we've been doing before. So it's a really aggressive removal or predator control program relative to some of the other states. Okay, so that gives some context. Then what happened here last year, 2 bills came up to the legislature, predator control funding by Senator Hinkins, and this is the one that puts the $5 fee on big game hunting licenses and with the purpose of removing predatory animals. Then the Mule Deer Protection Act by Senator Oakland, which requires the division to reduce coyote populations for the benefit of mule deer. And it does this by authorizing the DWR to contract with members of the target to remove coyotes from places where they can impact mule deer. Pretty specific. What we're doing with the funds, predator control funding, a lot of that's going to go over to Wildlife Services. We're going to contract with those guys to hit a lot of the high elevation, sensitive areas as we have been in the past. That's where most of those funds went before. And then the Mule Deer Protection Act is going to fund our public contracts that we're getting up and running right now. The way the law is designed, the Mule Deer Protection Act actually has 2 tiers of a general predator control program and a targeted predator control program. Now, in the general predator control program, this is designed to have contracts for coyote removal from people, the general public. This is going to get up and running. It's actually already started now. Aspects of it have started now. This is the part that most people are thinking about, the $50 per coyote thing that's got all the sort of press right now. The other half of it, and this is kind of interesting, is the targeted predator control program. And this one allows us to target, or instructs us actually, to target specific areas and specific places using preferred vendors. And what we mean by preferred vendors are specific members of the public. So hiring people to go out and do the work rather than just take any coyote from anywhere. So the biology on it, so we have made some recommendations, and we're trying to get this, the message to the public as good as we can, that, I mean, it's called the Mule Deer Protection Act. It's about deer. It's not about just removing coyotes. It's about trying to help the deer herd as best we can. We try to remind people of that. So what we're doing is we're trying to recommend locations for removals and targeting places where the removals might have the best benefit. Obviously, deer fawning grounds, those elevations are going to do more benefit than a coyote from a lot of parts of the West Desert or Nebraska or Kansas for that matter, right? So we want to keep people focused on places that's going to help Utah. Then we're also asking people to time their removals for the best times of year where it has the most chance of impacting coyote populations. And the most efficient removal is going to be after the coyote social groups have formed, when they've got their territory stable. That means they're going to be there in, you know, when fawns hit the ground. And it's also the time before the coyotes, the pups have been produced. You'd want to remove two or one versus, you know, six pups. So we're trying to get people thinking that way. Okay, we put together the map of general locations. You don't need to see this. You can download this from the web. The pink areas are areas where our deer herds are most prevalent. We're trying to focus people in those places. And in order to participate in the program, we try to keep this really simple, but at the same time make it so it's really accountable and we know what we're doing with all these funds. It's quite a bit of money. What we have people do is register first. They have to take an informal test and agree to the requirements. And basically the test just shows you the map and where you should go, talks about the seasons, talks about the biology. It's 10 questions just to get people so they know everything they need to know in order to get reimbursed for the coyotes, get that all up front. They have to turn in some information, their address, social security number, because this is taxable income. We'll have to send 1099s and all that kind of stuff out too. It's kind of a big deal, so we have to follow the state's purchasing rules in order to make this all happen. So in terms of requesting compensation, then people would have to come in with their scalp with the ears on it or a pelt with the jaw. If they're going to come in, what I'd really encourage people to do is if they're going to come in, and I'd like to have them do it December or January, we'd like to do it the right time of year, and also take the pelt that they can still sell and sell their pelt and collect the $50 from the state as well. So it'd really be nice to get people to maximize the use of this resource. And they have to come with the lower jaw that we can use. We want to get some population information on the coyotes. We also want to get some tissue on these guys too, because I'm going to put together a database of genetics, and the hope is to identify regions where coyotes have come from. What I'd really like to be able to do is make sure we can document what's a genetic Utah coyote versus one from Kansas or wherever else in the state, and again try to help people be a little more honest about this, because if they're cheating, it's not going to help Utah deer at all. It's going to be important for them to go only to posted locations. They can't just go into any division office, or just can't show up in my office or show up to law enforcement personnel, and then they'll get their $50 per coyote. Okay. Again, recommended submitting in December. You can collect their coyotes right now. It started July 1st. That's when everything went into effect. They'll need to hold clean scalps and everything until we're ready to do it. And the locations and times will be updated on the web at our wildlife, at our predators website that we have set up. So that's all up and running and good to go right now. And it does seem, it's been a little frustrating for folks because, hey, this law hit the books. Why is it taking so long? One is it's a new big statewide program. No one's ever done anything like this before. $500,000 to thousands of people. There's a lot of potential for cheating or fraud and that kind of thing. So we have to be on top of it. We have to follow our state purchasing rules. And also, we're trying to set up our locations such that nobody has to travel. People from southern Utah, we don't want them to have to travel up to Logan or someplace like that. We're going to try to set it up so no one has to travel more than an hour to turn in their coyotes. And we're trying to do this without hiring any additional people or very few additional FTEs in order to make the guts of the program, that $500,000, all just go towards the reimbursements versus inflating what we're doing. So it's been complicated, but we should be going here in a couple weeks. The targeted predator control program going to start fall 2023. Remember, this is the other half of the law. People will need a track record. So one of the other reasons we're collecting information from people as they turn animals in, they will then have a track record. Folks that are really good at doing this, that gather good information, that are able to turn in good stuff in good forms, we can put them as on a list as approved vendors. Then we can go back to them and give them private contracts to hunt in places where we might have missed. One of the things we are collecting are GPS locations. I might have glossed over that. We want a GPS or a good solid location from each coyote. And one of the reasons for that is so we can see which places we're hitting, which places we're missing, and if there's those donut holes in the middle, then that's what we use this program for, to fill in those places where the general public's missing. So it's a pretty well thought out and put together control program. Finally, a lot of questions about, is this going to work? Is this not going to work? What should we be thinking about? Fact is, the science, sometimes predator removal works, sometimes it doesn't. We're giving this one the college try. We're putting a lot of effort and time into this, and we've been publicizing this and getting as many people as we can. So far, to this day, 2,970 people, I think, have signed up to the program. So we're going to have somewhere on the order of 3,000 people starting right now. One of the things we have to remember is, though, is it's not just coyotes that are impacting deer. There's habitat, there's weather, there's a lot of other factors that are important as well. So you can't expect just one thing to do everything. If you want to remove all the coyotes in the state, we're trying to manage people's expectations. It's pretty unlikely we're going to remove 70% of coyotes for several years in a row and remove coyotes from the state. That's not going to happen. But they can impact coyotes in smaller populations, in smaller areas. We hope that the populations are reduced and our fawn survival will be increased. We're on the edge of our seat watching to see how this works out. And again, we're going to use the location, age of coyotes, population data in order to evaluate the program and see, is this worth the $500,000 a year? Is it really helping stuff out? So we're gathering information on it. And that was the kind of rundown for you guys.
Any questions for John? Sam?
The registration and the test that you referred to, is that web-based?
Web-based, yes, sir.
Okay. Harry?
How do you envision, in terms of the locations, for example, somebody from Kanab, are you looking at relatively close to these smaller cities? They might have to travel Cedar City or something like that?
Right, exactly, and that's been the struggle. So what we're working with all the managers and everybody right now, each region is setting up their plan to figure out how best to do it, to spread out. Southern region's a tough one, because this is big down here. So Teresa's working on trying to do, eight different locations, and it won't be it won't be 8 hours a day, every day at eight locations. It's going to be one place for half a day, another place for half a day, and another place for half a day. So people can either travel a long way, or they can wait and turn it in on a day. But we'll get that posted so people can plan ahead, and we're trying to, get that up and running as soon as we can right now. That's the plan.
Another question.
What kind of participation are we getting on this so far?
We've got almost 3,000 people signed up so far.
And we haven't done anything on the coyotes yet as far as having them turn in? When is it we start doing
No,
that?
And we've our target is September 1st to start having our locations up and running. If we can get something before that, we'll try. But we've got a lot of software. I mean, the process is someone will show up to the designated location. They have a little form that says that I've taken the test or whatever, I've registered, and another form that has coyote, date, location, and their name at the top. Then we process that form. We run through the software. It says 6 coyotes, $300, puts their information through the web, and then we hand them a receipt, and then they get a check mailed to them. So that's what's kind of leading us towards. We've got people can collect coyotes now, but we're not going to be ready till September. And I think what you're going to see in September at first, the floodgates open and a bunch of people show up, and then we'll adjust dates, times, and locations depending on where most people are turning coyotes into. So this will evolve still a little bit.
Okay, and what about coyotes that are not taken in specified areas to the counties? And I believe it's through wool growers or cattlemen, they have bounties. Is that still going to be active during this period of time as well?
Some of the counties are still doing it. Some of them aren't. So it's up to the county. So the Department of Agriculture. That money goes through them, then goes to the counties. And a lot of them had said, why are we, the state's doing this $50. They were doing $20, I think. So most of them have said there's really no need, and they've dropped out of it. But I don't know what the count is on how many are doing it and how many aren't.
I think a lot of the counties were encouraged to use the money that they had in their
to
budgets
push into,
to
right.
push into predator control with Wildlife Services during their budget year.
Right.
And I don't know how many did that or not.
Right. Thanks, Mike.
Other questions? Questions from the public? Again, it's an informational item. I appreciate John putting that on. There was a lot of discussion and questions. I hope, as RAC members, we can disseminate better information now after having that. Thanks a lot, John. It's excellent. Waterfowl, you're up, Blair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the RAC. Tonight I'll be presenting the waterfowl recommendations for the 2012 and 2013 season. And in order to formulate our recommendations, there's two important surveys that are analyzed each year. The first one of those is the habitat survey, and that's a pond index that's conducted each spring, looking at a number of ponds in the high-production waterfowl areas in North America. The second one is a waterfowl breeding survey, and that's a pair survey that's also conducted at the same time, looking at the number of waterfowl pairs in those areas. And first, I wanted to summarize the findings for these two surveys. This year, as compared to last, pretty much everywhere where the surveys were conducted, the overall waterfowl conditions were down. And comparing that to the long-term average, it's a little above average to about consistent to what it's been over the long term. And so it's nothing to really worry about too much. Last year was just a really, really wet year, and so it's quite a bit drier in the high production areas compared to 2011. As far as the actual bird populations are concerned, the Rocky Mountain population of geese is doing really well in Utah. We're higher than we were last year, and that's actually due to that we had a little drier spring this last year. In 2011, it was really, really wet, and we had a lot of nests that were flooded out, and so we had a lower number of pairs, but this year we have really good production across the state and a lot of goose pairs. Compared to the long-term average, we are down a little bit from where, that long-term, but we are looking really well. Across the flyway, things are also looking really well for geese, so it's a good sign there. Tundra swans, they're actually doing really well, too. We conduct a survey every winter, and on those surveys we are up from 2011 as well as up from our long-term average. We also analyze the swans from the Alaska survey, and those numbers are all looking really well too. So swans are doing really good. Looking at our duck populations, there are several species on here that I just want to highlight really quick. Mallards are one of the biggest or most important species that we look at when we're setting our waterfowl recommendations. Depending on what the mallard population is how liberal or conservative of a season we'll have. And so with the high mallard numbers, that's a really good sign. And the reason why mallards are used is because they're a really good index to the overall waterfowl population. The several species that we've kind of been concerned about the last few years, one of those is pintail. And this year, numbers were down compared to last year. And they're also lower than their long-term average. And that can be a little bit deceiving because on years like this, when the prairies are really dry, a lot of those birds will go a little bit farther north to nest where it's a little bit wetter. And so it may be that the pintail population was a little bit higher, but that we weren't able to detect that in our surveys. But, I mean, it is what it is, and it is lower than it has been for the long term, so that is a bit of a concern. Canvasback are doing about the same as they were last year, and overall they are on a trend up, and so it is possible in the next couple of years that we can see a more liberal canvasback bag. Scaup numbers, they're kind of one of the highlight species for the flyway. They continue to go up and are looking really well from where they've been over the last 5 or 6 years. This year they continue to go up again, and they're about at that place where they're at their long-term average, though, so that's really good. Redhead numbers, another species that we're a little bit concerned about, they continue to do really well. They're about their long-term average right now, a little bit above it, so nothing to really be concerned about there. Overall, the duck population was up 7% from last year and about 43% from the long-term average. So like I was saying earlier, based on the mallard populations is how we select our season lengths. And so because we did have a good mallard population again this year, the Fish and Wildlife Service allows us to have a liberal season. And what that means is the number of days we can hunt and how big how large our bag will be. So for the liberal season this year, we'll be able to have another 107-day season and a 7-bird bag. Of those species of concern, the pintails will be able to have a 107-day season, but there'll be 2 birds again. Camelback will be another 170 season with 1 bird in the bag. And scop, which have actually increased from last year, will be a 170 season with a 7-bird bag. So to give you our recommendations for the season dates, the duck season will begin on October 6th and run through the 19th of January statewide. That'll be for 7 birds a day and 14 in possession. There'll be no more than 2 hen mallards, 2 pintails, 2 redheads, and 1 canvasback. And the coop bag will be the same season dates with a bag of 25. For the dark geese, northern zone, the dates will be October 6th through the 19th of January. Outside of that zone, it'll be from the 6th to the 18th of October, and then with a break in between there, resume again on the 27th of October and run until the 27th of January. The bag will be 3 and 6 in possession. The light goose in the northern zone will be October 27th through January 19th. It starts a little bit later to accommodate that late season white goose hunt that we've had. So that'll resume again on the 18th of February and run until the 10th of March. In the rest of the state, the season will be October 16th through the 19th, and then resume again on March 1st through the 10th. The daily limit for the white geese is 10 with a possession of 20. The snipe season will be the same as the duck season, October 6th through the 19th of January, with 8 daily or 16 in possession. Swan season will be October 6th through December 9th. And that'll be just within the Great Salt Lake hunting area, and that'll be 2,000 permits, like last year. The falconry season dates, October 6th through the 19th, with 3 daily or 6 in possession. And the youth day this year will be on September 22nd, so 2 weeks before the opening of the general duck season. Shooting hours, we do have some restrictions on the northern counties. That's Box Elder, Salt Lake, Davis, Weber, and Cache County. We recommend a 7:30 opener again for that county. They're those counties just because we have a high number of waterfowlers in that area, so we want it to be a little bit lighter. The rest of the state, it'll just be a half hour before sunrise. And then for the rest of the season, it'll be the same as always, a half hour before sunrise and a half hour after sunset. There are some temporary closures that may occur on some of the waterfowl management areas around the Great Salt Lake in an effort to control the Phragmites, which is an invasive plant species up there. We may close some of those down in order to burn some of the residual cover off. It allows us to reduce Phragmites by being able to actually spray it more effectively if we get that residual cover off. And so if that does occur, then we'll use the proper immediate outlets to try to spread that message to as many hunters as possible. There is one northern region specific recommendation. It's for the Antelope Island Causeway, where we've had some issues with conflicts between birding groups and hunters and just people going out to look at Antelope Island. So we've recommended that a 600-foot buffer be established on both sides of the road, beginning at a fee booth on the east side, so essentially in the Syracuse area, and just running along that causeway to the Antelope Island. And that's all that I have for the recommendations.
Thanks, Blair. Any questions from the RAC? Questions from the public? Got one comment card from Paul Niemeyer.
You want me to ask a question and give a comment both?
Sure. Just for you.
How many trumpeters do they kill in the state in a year, do you think? What are your records showing that?
We do. In order to actually have our swan season, the Fish and Wildlife Service requires that we monitor the take of trumpeter swans. And so in a given year, it usually ranges between anywhere from 0 up to about 5. I think the highest we've ever had was where 7 trumpeters actually taken. And that was in a year when we'd done a release earlier in the year, and so there were more trumpeters in the area. But on a given year, it's probably maybe 3 or 4.
Are the trumpeters doing pretty good nationwide?
They are. They continue to increase. They become kind of a focal species for the Pacific flyway, and so we've done a lot more monitoring and assessing their populations, and they continue to increase, not to the point where you could actually harvest them or have a season, but they are doing fairly well, and it's not really much of a concern. If we did harvest a lot of trumpeters, it would be, and that's why we have some of those triggers in place to actually close the swan season if we do harvest too many of those.
I guess where I'm coming from on this is we used to could hunt swans in this end of the state, and then they came out and said, well, there's a bigger chance of killing a trumpeter in this end of the state. And then they shut it down, and the only place you can hunt them is in a few of those areas up north. But I guess I would like to recommend that we look at reinstating some swan tags down here. Maybe you could limit it so many to this southern Utah or into the zone. Is it still zone 1 and 2 now?
It's not. It's just a statewide season.
But I mean, is the state, you know, we had the zone 1 and 2. I don't know what they even call it now. You know, like your duck season ends different, or your goose hunt ends up there a week earlier before it does here. I think they call it zone 1 and zone 2. But anyway, I'd like to see them look at reinstating some swan hunting opportunity down here. And then the other thing is we're starting to get more sandhill cranes down here all the time. I counted over 400 in one day last year. And I'd like to see them, and I know it's going to have to go through the Pacific Flyway Council, but still, we need to, if you're ever going to get anything, we got to start here at the rack and work through and try and, it, best case scenario, it'd probably be next year to even do anything. But these cranes are on the increase. You're seeing more that are raised here, and plus the ones that are migrating through. And the crane hunt would probably be better down here later than it is up there. Up there, they're doing it about September. When we really see them down here is about from the middle of October to about the middle of November. There were some I know that wintered. I think they wintered. I saw them the last of January at Paiute. But, you know, I would like to see. It seems kind of unfair that we always have to go up north. It's sometimes I think the whole state of Utah thinks they end at Provo, but I would like to see some opportunity for the people down here. You know, these cranes, you know, I'm sure nationwide they've got to be on the increase from everything I can see, you know, clearing to Canada and you know, all the prairie potholes in the boreal forest and all that. But I would like to see, you know, some recommendations for some seasons to be able to hunt both those species somewhere besides just up there. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. We've got a follow-up. Blair, what is the process for expanding that tundra swan hunt or?
Yeah, both of those are both species covered under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And so in order to change the seasons, and a lot of the actual areas or dates that you can hunt, you have to go through the federal agency to do that. And so for our swan, we have a pretty tight contract with the Fish and Wildlife Service to only hunt within that Great Salt Lake area. It's something that could be looked at in the future, and if that's something that you guys wanted to pursue, it's something that, you know, it could possibly be doable. We would have to negotiate with the Fish and Wildlife Service and allow them to actually give us permission to do that. As far as the cranes, that's also a possibility. Right now we do it in the highest populations of cranes we have in the state, so those four counties in northern Utah. We have started looking at cranes more in southern Utah, trying to get a feel for what the population numbers are, and so that's something we're continually monitoring and could definitely be a possibility in the future as well. The Fish and Wildlife Service does give us a certain allotment of cranes, though, that we can harvest every year. And so if we were to open up a season down here, you would be pulling permits from other parts of the state to only harvest that certain number of cranes. So.
Great, thanks. Rack discussion. That concludes public comment. Further discussion by the rack. Mac.
Did you say on the sandhill cranes, is there a maximum number of permits? You say you have to move some from the north down the south to use it?
Yeah, the Fish and Wildlife Service only allows us to harvest a certain number of cranes. And so, like, for instance, with this year, we could only shoot 127 total cranes. And so if we were to open up a season down here, it would have to adjust permits accordingly so that we didn't harvest more than 126. And so in order to do that, you'd probably have to take permits from like the Box Elder County Hunt or the Cache Hunt or the Rich Hunt or something like that. But it's also in proportion to our cranes populations and surveys that we do every year in September. And so depending on how those populations fluctuate, I mean, some years we could have more permits, and so it, you know, just depending on where the cranes are at is we'd like to hunt them, so.
Well, so how do you get more permits?
It's basically just in proportion to how many cranes you actually have in your state during the survey period. And so if our number of cranes were to increase, then we'd be given a larger allotment of cranes that we could harvest.
When do you count the cranes?
We're southern Utah.
I think we have plenty.
Yeah, they're specified dates that the Fish and Wildlife Service gives us every year, and they're September, usually 10th through the 15th. And so that's when we conduct our survey. And so, you know, depending on when the cranes actually move through down here, if it's later in the year, then we're probably not counting as many of those cranes. And they may be cranes that are moving from northern Utah down, or, you know, it's hard to say.
What about the cranes that stay year-round?
We have done some surveys in the past, and so if they were here year-round, we would be detecting them. I know Vance Mumford did some surveys last year around Richfield and counted some. I couldn't tell you how many for sure. So if there's areas in the state, you know, where we're starting to see more and more cranes, we'll probably start to do more and more surveys in there to try to get a better idea of how many cranes we have statewide.
They come down the Bicknell Bottoms. There's some year-round. All you got to do is plant your grain in your field, then they show up.
Yeah.
Mike.
Is the number of permits tied to, or are there permits for depredation for on crops? I know some states do that, like Idaho.
Yeah, and again, it's something that goes through the Fish and Wildlife Service. In the past, we haven't really done much of that. We've issued cracker shells or propane cannons and things like that to try to deter cranes from feeding in fields like that. But we haven't ever done any kind of lethal removal like that for cranes.
More discussion? Somebody ready to make a motion? We can certainly ask the Wildlife Board to put it on the action log. Go ahead, Cordell. Sam.
I move that we accept the DWR proposal on the waterfowl recommendations, but I would like to add to the action log or whatever we need to do to get Paul's concerns addressed. I'm not exactly sure how to word that, Paul, on what you want on there. I know it had to do with the
just look
the,
for additional swans, opportunity with
right,
swans and cranes in southern Utah.
Sounds great. What Steve said.
Any second on that motion? Seconded by Claire. You want to read something back, Stephanie, so we know what we're voting on? Yeah, for cranes or sandhill cranes and swans, tundra swans. Discussion on the motion? Let's take a vote. Those in favor? Any against? That looked unanimous. Thank you. Moving on to other business. Dan, you want to talk to us about changes you'd like to see in the Cougar Guidebook?
I would. I appreciate the opportunity. My name's Dan Cockayne. I'm a houndsman and also the lion coordinator for the Utah Houndsman Association. We realize that cougars aren't on the agenda. They're listed in, on the DWR website as the guidebook changes for this rack, and so that's why we wanted to be here for sure. But cougars are kind of a unique species. I've been in the woods all my life and I never seen one except with my hounds, and so they're hard to count. It's hard to know how many there are and where they're at. There is science, and I know this managing cougars in North America is part of the management plan, and so as a As a line coordinator, I've traveled all over the state pretty much end to end, side to side in the past 4 or 5 months talking to houndsmen because they're very concerned about the lion populations. And mostly the harvest of females, the records are showing that the female harvest is increasing and the age is decreasing. So basically we're killing the young females, which can devastate a population. The target for harvesting for adjusting the tags is between 17 and 20% harvest on females. In 2011, we harvested 39% females. In 2012, we harvested 34% females. And then if you also take into consideration, I emailed most of you, or tried to, this, and I've got a copy, and I'll leave it so everyone gets one. But a study recently in Montrose, Colorado, they had 3 collared females that were taken. It was legal to kill a collared female. They orphaned 8 kittens, and they were all euthanized and their collars taken off because they weren't old enough to survive. So if you take the numbers of the females that we've harvested the last 2 years of our 3-year plan, and even if you consider half that many kittens are going to be orphaned and die, we're taking females at the rate of about 50%, females and kittens, and we're alarmed. The houndsmen, some of them 30, 40 years of experience in the field, everywhere I go are saying there's no lions. We can't find lions. These aren't amateurs. These are men who've been, riding their mules, running the roads. They're just dwindling. I think we've targeted lions as a predator for the deer and with very few results. And we need to look at the lions before we take them all. The other unique thing about the lions is they're not only hunted, they're also opportunity for a non-consumptive tag to just go pursue the lion. And if there's no lions, that's not happening. That's a lot of dollars, typically for me, I buy a rifle, a couple boxes of shells, I take a couple tanks of gas and go hunt a deer a couple weeks a year. My hounds, I feed them day after day after day. I buy gas, I travel, I train them, and I've bought coyote dogs because there's coyotes everywhere, and it's tougher and tougher to find a lion. And based on the science and the experience of the houndsman, we feel like we're at a serious critical point. So we would like to see things done to protect the females, whether it's lower the tags, which we love to see, and revert the harvest objective to a male only. We could still have the numbers, but preserve that base to take care of the population. A couple other things that we would like to see, and that could be done when we adjust the guidebook for the dates and stuff this year. There's a voluntary cougar orientation course to identify its excellent materials, and hardly anyone is using it. We'd like to see that mandatory for any permit holder, anyone guiding a permit holder, any outfitter that's outfitting a permit holder, that course is mandatory. We do it on almost every other species, and it doesn't cost anything to do that. We'd like to also, and I've met with John, talked to him about updating that and putting more of an emphasis in making and helping the hunters understand how we affect the population by taking a female. If we take a male cougar, another male will move into that area and take care of the breeding. If we take a female, she averages 12 kittens in her lifetime that survive. If half of those are females, by the third generation, killing that one lion has taken over 2,000 cougars. It's a huge impact to take those females. We'd also like to see the split moved up to April 1st. So it's not a, what we find is in the spring is the ideal time to take a cougar. So you wait 8-10 years to get a limited entry tag. And then right when all the good storms are hitting and the good conditions to take a lion, it switches to limited entry. And a lot of females are taken. If those guys who have waited all that time to take a trophy animal have a little more time, their odds of taking a mature male increases by doing that. The other target for or the other trigger for adjusting the numbers are the pursuit numbers. Right now, we do a random survey on pursuit holders. We'd like to see that mandatory for everyone who holds a pursuit tag to take that. It's a 5 minutes on the computer. I took it this year. The information collected is really good, and it just makes for better science and better management doing that. There's a study on the Okers and a study on the Monroe. On the Okers, a collared cougar is not legal to take. On the Monroe, a collared cougar is legal to take. So we're taking our hunters' dollars, our taxpayer dollars, and paying these guys to go track these cougars, tranquilize them, collar them, and then we're killing them. We're not studying anything. We're killing them. I think Clint Meekum told us that four or five of the females that he collared were taken this year. It doesn't make any sense to not protect those collared cougars. So we'd like to see that statewide a collared cougar is off limits. And then finally, we would like to see it mandatory that all the kill sites are GPS and that information is recorded. There was just recently a case in down here over by Moab, I believe, where they were taking, I believe they were actually killing cougars in Colorado and tagging them with Utah tags. But regardless, they're, because during the limited entry season and the harvest objective season, there's also, they coincide. And so there are a lot of incidents where a cougar is taken off of a limited entry area, depriving that guy who has a tag for there and tagged with the harvest objective tag on another one. So it'd be a law enforcement tool, and it would be a good tool for the biology, so we know exactly where these cougars are being taken. The last five of those things could be adjusted in the guidebook without changing anything with the management plan. They're just little housekeeping things that will save some females. And I feel personally that we need to take care of those females. We're killing too many of them. 3 years may be too long, I don't know. That's all I have.
Thanks, Dan. Follow-up question for John Shivick. Remind us, John, the process of the timing that we're in with the Cougar Proclamation. I think what Dan was talking about, I pulled out my copy of the 2012 Wildlife Rack Board schedule off the internet, and it shows a placeholder there for Cougar Guidebook and Rule in this meeting where it's traditionally been done. We're at the first year of a three-year proclamation, right?
No, we're at the second year of a three-year proclamation on cougars, yeah. And the placeholder is just that, so when they put together the schedule, they put in what's been traditionally there and then use it just as a placeholder. And then what actually happens is, you know, is the agenda that we put together. So it's the second year. And this is actually, I mean, it's great. Dan's here. We've been communicating. We've visited at the offices and things. And I think he's, to address some of his ideas, he's got some actually pretty relevant and good ideas and things, I think, that we'll talk about. And this is, maybe it's a little early, but what I'm hoping to do is that I'll keep working with the Houndsmen. We'll put stuff together. So by the time we're actually hitting cougars again this time next year, I think they'll have a kind of a nice package of stuff to, you know, to present, and stuff that we can, you know, work with them on too. So I'm actually looking forward to this process. So
hypothetically, if the harvest this year were way out of the performance targets.
Right. Next year we would do some, we'd do the adjustments.
But you wouldn't change it midstream?
we haven't really hit any kind of a threshold to make us change midstream. And again, the three-year recommendations, the reason for that, as you know, in any given year, you've got, especially with things like cougars, a late snow versus an early snow bears, same kind of thing. It really impacts how many of these animals are taken. So any one year isn't the population. It really helps us to have a three-year block so we can be pretty reliable about the information that we have so we can make informed decisions going forward versus kind of chasing our tails. So that's why it was set up that way, and it's a good process, and there's no plan right now to do any kind of an emergency thing with the cougars.
Thank you. Question, Lane?
John, if I remember right, when we changed the cougar management plan, we went to the regions or the bigger zones.
Right.
Aren't there triggers in place so that if that harvest of females gets to a certain point, boom, we cut it off? I'm trying to remember.
I've got the plan here. It's more about, and I'm just looking at the numbers from this year in terms of, you know, we're not hitting our female quotas even. The split units didn't get up to what the quotas were for, or the sub quotas were for females and things. The plan's more, it's probably more a little aggressive the other way around in terms of leaving harvest objectives open than, and keeping the split units open for quotas than shutting it down on an emergency plan.
And that's the word I was looking for. If I remember right, there was some wording in there about a female sub quota on these harvest objective units.
That's what would do it,
yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah, no, there's language in there that would initially shut those things down and with this female sub quotas, but we didn't hit those things for the most units.
Good discussion. Other questions? Sorry to put you on the spot, John.
It's okay. I'm thoroughly unprepared.
Yeah, you got it all in the folder. Anything else? This is just informational. Dan, appreciate you coming, and we've got captured that in our minutes, and we'll see what goes on with other racks and take it up at the board meeting. Anyone have any other business? Motion to adjourn.
I make a motion we adjourn.
So moved. Thank you.